Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. StaffordLaw.com.
The wind on the plain, what the west wind saw, the girl with the flaxen hair, the engulfed cathedral, the dance of Puck, dead leaves, the fairies are exquisite dancers.
Those are just some of the titles Claude Debussy gives to his preludes. I'm Emily Auerbach.
And I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Late in his life, French composer Claude Debussy created a series of preludes bringing together a wide variety of sources, ranging from the fairy tales of Hans Christian Andersen to captions for pictures in Peter Pan. Taken together, books 1 and 2 of the preludes, published in 1910 and 1913, represent Debussy's largest single work for the piano. Joining us to explore the sources, historical context, and musical intricacy of the preludes is Catherine Kowski, professor of music at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and chair of the keyboard department.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you at the piano. We call them preludes. Debussy called them preludes. Usually a prelude comes before something else, like with Bach. It's a prelude and fugue. Why the term prelude for these otherwise colorfully titled pieces of Debussy?
Yeah, that's the great question. Debussy wasn't the first person, however, to write preludes that weren't preludes to anything, although it fits him particularly well. But Chopin already wrote preludes that were simply independent pieces. They kind of became a character piece in the 19th century. A prelude was a kind of genre that people were attracted to. So you have preludes by Chopin, you have preludes by Rachmaninoff, preludes by Scriabin, and then preludes by Debussy. And I think all of these people were kind of attracted by the miniaturism of the form, the implied sense that in some sense it was almost incomplete. And that would have appealed especially to Debussy, who loved the idea of things sort of trailing off into thin air. So it's a prelude to what? To sort of infinity. And in fact, at the end, he, instead of putting titles at the beginning, he always puts his titles at the end, which is already odd. And then to make it even odder and to sort of apologize for them in a way, he always puts them in parentheses, and then he follows them with 3 dots, with the ellipsis sign. So again, it's as if it's a prelude to something. Something's supposed to follow that sign, right? And yet we never know what it is. So it's a form, if one wants to call it that, a genre is a better word, that's just perfect for Debussy in that sense, because its very vagueness would be exactly what he would like, its lack of boundaries.
Is there something peculiarly French about these preludes? I mean, we think about this time period as being a time of nationalism in music with the Germans and so on.
Right.
Here Debussy is creating these works that you sampled as we opened the hour. Is there something particularly French?
Yeah, I think I don't think that the genre itself is necessarily nationalistic in any way. I mean, you have Russian and Polish, you know, composers of every nationality writing in it. But again, the miniaturism of it appealed to Debussy as a statement, I think, of his Frenchness. If you place this in the context of what's going on in Germanic music in the second half of the 19th century, if you think about people like Wagner, above all, but also Bruckner, Mahler, even Brahms, this sort of enormity of the forms, which Debussy saw as a kind of constant overstatement, I think. And he wasn't alone. He was, I think, perhaps influenced even by his countryman, or maybe the influence went the other way, I don't know which, Satie, who was very eager to establish what he called a music without sauerkraut, which I think is just the most memorable phrase. And I think that's exactly how they felt about it. They really detested the Germans. I mean, Debussy had sort of a love-hate relationship with Wagner. He was incredibly attracted to the music. He certainly understood its greatness. And yet he found it really, I think, very pompous and sort of overblown. So if you place these preludes, which are each about 2 minutes long, in the context of a Wagner opera, which goes on 5 hours, then you see how you're certainly creating an antithesis here.
An antithesis of tone, too. It seemed to me that a lot of the French composers, I mean, Chabrier is one who comes to mind, who went to Bayreuth and was just totally bowled over by Wagner and really had to work to get out from the Wagnerian thumb, to break away from that influence, and went just as far as they could go, sometimes even doing little satires of
Wagner.
Right.
Well, of course, the Debussy, his insertion of that little bit of Tristan in the middle of Gollywog's Cakewalk is the perfect example of the satire, right? Where could you put it to thumb your nose more effectively and then in the middle of a children's cakewalk? But I think that, you know, despite all their efforts, of course, they were enormously influenced by Wagner. They couldn't help but be. And that sort of stretch of tonality into this enormous chromaticism is exactly their taking off point. So Debussy couldn't possibly have done what he does tonally if it weren't for Wagner. I mean, I can play you the opening of one of the more famous preludes, actually, Voile, which is right near the beginning of the first book. And it starts like this, using only a whole tone scale, and then the augmented triads that result from that. And there's no key center that you can possibly find. This pedal comes in on B flat, but that's not what he's established at all. So you have in music a kind of a music that's very pleasing to the ear, but that nevertheless is in many ways the beginning of atonality. I mean, that simply avoids key centers a lot of the time. And that couldn't have happened without Wagner having stretched tonality as basically as far as it could go.
What about the passion? Though, I mean, Wagner, romantic passion, nationalism aside, you know, very, very torrid stuff in a lot of places. Do we find that in these little preludes of Debussy?
I don't think that's what Debussy is interested in. Not, I don't mean that this is cold music. I don't think it's cold music at all. But he uses the word lointain all the time, which means far away in French or distant. And I think, you know, Wagner is writing about the gods who are sort of right in your face, right? And as you said, their passions are so intense. And Debussy is much more interested in a kind of distance and almost in a world of dreams and of fairies and of make-believe. That's where he wants to reside. You know, I think, and it's always risky to be biographical, but from everything I've read, this was not an easy man. This was not a person who got along easily with other people. And there's a sense in which the music is a kind of wonderful escape from the torridness of human passions, if you will. So there's not much about human beings here. There's a lot more about fairies.
Also, there's a playfulness in the preludes, as if somehow, I mean, if you can contrast that with sitting through a long opera on a hard wooden seat.
Yes, absolutely.
It seems as if it's having fun with
I agree. There's really very little that's outright funny in Wagner, right? He's not heavily into humor. But Debussy, yes, is very funny a lot of the time. I mean, one of the preludes, General Levine Eccentric, begins like this. And it's about a clown who apparently played the piano with his toes. So he's very drawn to the circus, for instance, which isn't surprising if you look at Toulouse-Lautrec, for instance. There are all these paintings of the circus. I think the French in general were very taken with entertainment at this time. There was a lot of entertainment that had just arrived there. And the influence of ragtime also is really important in Debussy's preludes and in a lot of what's being written in Paris at that time. Stravinsky wrote rag music in Paris at that time also. Again, how much farther could you get from Wagner, right? So there's this sense of wanting to play with music in all sorts of ways. Another good example of that would be the Interrupted Serenade, where this is also one from the first book. Let me just leaf through here and find it. Where this poor lover is trying to serenade, and he keeps getting started, and you hear his guitar very regularly, ostensibly very happily, and then he starts again. And it keeps happening. And in fact, Debussy writes above it, rageur, which means in a rage. So you know, you have these characters who Debussy is probably sympathetic to, but is also obviously making fun of. Also, Pickwick is another one, which begins like this. If you've read any of Pickwick papers, I think I have a great quote, actually, if I can find it, that comes from Pickwick. You know that Pickwick was this sort of English gentleman who could never quite get things right. I mean, he kind of bumbled through life. This is how Dickens introduces him. Those who knew that the gigantic brain of Pickwick was working beneath that forehead and that the beaming eyes of Pickwick were twinkling behind those glasses, there sat the man who had traced to their source the mighty ponds of Hampstead and agitated the scientific world with his theory of tittle bats. So, you know, there you have it. And how does he begin? But with this incredibly pompous, magisterial rendition of God Save the King. So, yes, lots and lots of humor.
Well, it's interesting that he draws on Dickens, who's known as partly a comic writer as well. What other writers in particular influenced Debussy?
You know, one interesting thing and sort of surprising thing about Debussy is how much he liked the English. Having lived in France for a year, I find this just astounding. Having lived both in France for a year and in England for a year, I find it astounding in both directions. But he did. He loved the English. He actually said that he thought they were superior to the French. And perhaps it's partly because of the literature. So we know he liked Dickens. He also adored Shakespeare, was familiar with all of Shakespeare. And one of the wonderful preludes is The Dance of Puck. That comes, again, in the first book. I can play you a little bit of the beginning of it, and you'll hear what a character Puck is. And again, that sense of complete surprise. You know, where did that possibly come from? So, yes, so we have Shakespeare, whom he adored, and he also loved an illustrator who was English, who illustrated not only English literature, but a lot of English literature. That's Arthur Rackham, who was known for his illustrations of Puck, and we have some of those. And we know that Debussy bought a lot of these books for his daughter. So that's the English. Then among the
He must have loved Peter Pan, too, though.
He loved Peter Pan, and we should come back to that, maybe, because Peter Pan is a question all on its own. But he was also very involved personally with the symbolist poets in France, and some of them were actually his personal friends, people like Verlaine. But one of the preludes is based very closely on a Baudelaire poem from Fleur de Mal, and that's the fourth one, Les Sons, les Parfums tournent dans l'air de soir. It's also a poem that Debussy actually set as a song, but here there are no words at all, and yet he evokes the poem. I can read you a little bit of perhaps the first verse of it. It begins, "Now is the time when, trembling on its stem, each flower fades away like incense. Sounds and scents turn in the evening air, a melancholy waltz, a soft and giddy mood." And the piece begins like this. Immediately, some of the imagery is so obvious. I mean, you have the melancholy waltz, which is impossible to ignore. And also a little bit of the sense of the rhyme scheme. You don't get it in the English translation, but in French, he uses only two word endings throughout the entire poem. And I think this sort of sense of the rising interval and then the falling interval. And that interval, especially the falling one, comes over and over in the piece. Here it is. So it's as if this interval kind of drifts in and out of the piece. And the poem itself is a pantoum, which means that lines from each verse are repeated in the following verse. And so you always have a sort of sense of familiarity in what you're reading. You always feel as if you've encountered it before. It's funny because when I read the poem, I didn't notice that it was a pantoum. I didn't notice that the lines were exactly the same that were being repeated. But there's a kind of hypnotic quality to it as you encounter these words you've encountered before. And I think that Debussy has that same hypnotic quality in this piece, where this interval keeps drifting in and out of the texture. So he was obviously very sensitive to literature. I mean, he's a great songwriter. And even the directions that he gives to the pianist are often very poetic. So literature was an enormous part of his life.
What about Hans Christian Andersen?
Yeah, well, that's another fun one. Peter Pan and Hans Christian Andersen, I guess, sort of grouped together as a nice segue into the fact that he was so influenced by children's literature. And I mentioned Arthur Rackham, who was, above all, a children's book illustrator. I don't know that much about his relationship with Hans Christian Andersen in general, but one of the preludes is based on a story. In fact, in my volume of Hans Christian Andersen, which I rescued from my childhood books, it's the first story. It's called The Garden of Paradise. And here it forms sort of the germ of the prelude, What the West Wind Saw, which is one of maybe the most powerful and virtuosic of the preludes. It starts like this. It starts very softly, but it grows. It's a massive amount of sound in this, and it sort of conveys this story of a young prince who's very bored and goes out for a walk and finds himself, oddly enough, in the home of the mother of the four winds. And none of the winds are home, so they sort of traipse in while this prince is there. And he asks each of them what they've been doing. And you get this story of what the West Wind had seen. He'd been off on some travels, and he comes back, and he says that he'd come from the forest wilderness where human beings seemed to be superfluous. And he's looked at the mighty river and been turning somersaults in the savannas. He was indeed a wild boy. So that's what Debussy took off from in this particular prelude.
Was he, before we get to Peter Pan, I have to ask about somebody who seems the antithesis, in a way, seems the antithesis of Debussy as a writer, and that'd be Kipling. Who was very prominent at this time.
Yeah, Kipling's a funny story because apparently Debussy wrote a prelude based on Kipling, and then he took it out. There's only one prelude, and there are two volumes of preludes. Each one has 12 preludes, so 24 altogether. And the 23rd one is the only one that has a name that is completely undescriptive or unreferential.
It's alternative
called Alternating Thirds, right? It goes like this. So, yeah, the piano is playing alternating thirds. But it doesn't, unlike all the other preludes, it doesn't tell us anything about some picturesque scene. Okay, but apparently, originally, there was a different prelude in there that was based on a Kipling story, To My and the Elephants, or something like that. And I read the story. It's sort of a fun story. It's about this boy who goes and he runs off. He's kind of wild and considered quite naughty. He runs away, and what he wants to do is see the dance of the elephants. And the elephants hold some sort of huge ceremonial dance, and humans have never seen it. And this boy manages to see it, so he becomes a huge hero. Well, so Debussy was very attracted to that story, obviously, and did write a piece about it, but then he rejected the piece. And I've never seen the piece. I don't know if it exists anymore or not. Certainly it's not published anywhere. That's the only reference that I know to Kipling, but maybe there are some other ones. I don't know. But I think it's the sort of tale that he would love. He loves anything that couldn't be true. You know? I think that's what appeals to him.
Sounds as if he was sort of a Peter Pan himself, and we're going to explore that and other topics in the preludes when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Fairies are exquisite dancers, one of the preludes of early 20th century French composer Claude Debussy. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest at the piano is Catherine Kowski. What really was exquisite. Tell us about the journey then from Peter Pan, the book, the story, to that piece you just played.
Well, that's a good question. I think the first thing to say is that the Peter Pan that Debussy knew is not the same Peter Pan that we know, and he was luckier, I would say. This is based on the original J.M. Barrie, Peter Pan in Kensington Gardens. And it's just a completely entrancing story. And it doesn't include any of the characters that we associate with Peter Pan. There's no Captain Hook. There's no Wendy. Instead, it's simply the story of Peter Pan's life in Kensington Gardens. And if you've ever been in Kensington Gardens in London, there's actually a wonderful statue of Peter Pan in the middle of Kensington Gardens that's still there. So I think the English half believe that he maybe is still around. So anyway, it's the story of his relationship with the fairies and his attempt really to be one of the fairies. And as he says somewhat sadly, he's betwixt and between. So he's not really human anymore. And in fact, one of the most moving moments in this story is when he decides that maybe he should go back after all. And he goes back to his home and he finds that there are bars on the window now. His mother has had a new baby, and she's so afraid that that baby will be carried away by the fairies that she's put bars on the windows to keep the fairies out. And of course, the bars keep Peter Pan out. So Peter Pan can't go back anymore to being a human child. And of course, he can't quite be a fairy because he's a boy. And so he's betwixt and between. But he's not in such bad company because he lives with these creatures who have such a wonderfully rich imaginative life. And their life is also very, very physical, which I think accounts for the feeling in this piece of flight and of dancing. There's this sort of constant image of the in the book of the fairies taking off. And, you know, the piece begins, you know, as if it's really, it's completely ungrounded. There's no tonality. It's very hard to grasp the rhythm. And, of course, you can't really hear individual notes even. So what better sort of metaphor for flight? And in this illustration that Debussy is evoking here, The Fairies Are Exquisite Dancers, maybe I didn't even say that. This is the title of an illustration by Arthur Rackham. The fairies are walking across a tightrope, and underneath there's a sort of gossamer spider web to catch them if they should fall. And on each end, there's a clarinet and there's a double bass to hold them up. But really, they don't need anything to catch them because they're airborne creatures. And they not only fly, but they dance. One of the nicest quotes, I think, in the piece is that the fairies never say, "We feel happy." They say, "We feel dancy." So again, there's this sort of sheer physicality to everything that Peter Pan is experiencing. And there's also a kind of wonderful correlation between imagination and reality. The distinction completely blurs. So I'll read you a quote. Peter Pan is playing a pipe, and he says, or the narrator says, "Was that a fish leaping in the water, or was it Peter playing leaping fish on his pipe? You can't tell which is which." And then another quote, "And sometimes he played the birth of birds, and then the mothers would turn round in their nests to see whether they had laid an egg." You know, and so the music became the reality. And I think that's exactly what Debussy wanted to have happen, right? He didn't want this sort of boring everyday life where you get up and eat eggs and toast for breakfast. He wanted to be playing these airs on his pipes, which evoked a whole world and felt to him just as real.
Where did he come from, anyway?
Where did Debussy come from?
So well, you know, France, I mean.
Yeah, he didn't come from anything. He came from a completely uneducated family, actually. You can go visit his birth home outside of Paris. It's been made into a sort of modest little museum now. But his family was not musical and not educated. So he did it all himself. I mean, he's an anomaly.
Other than avoiding Wagner,
what else influenced him?
What positive influences did he have?
Well, I mean, I think Wagner was actually a very positive influence. I'm told this only because I love Schumann, and someone told me that Debussy loved Schumann also, that I see a lot of actual connections with Schumann.
Really?
That's odd.
The Girl with the Flaxen Hair is the only one that even strikes me at all as Schumann-esque because it has those chords.
Yeah, and I don't know if the... I'm not sure if the connection is exactly in how the music sounds so much as Schumann also was so interested in the unconscious. And in, I think it's true in the music in the sense that Schumann also wrote miniatures. He often put them together in a cycle, but he broke away from sonatas and from symphonies. That wasn't his strongest suit. His strongest suit was this being able to put an idea into a very confined space, and very often he jumped from one thing to another completely unexpectedly, this kind of non sequitur. And Debussy does exactly the same thing. I mean, we saw it in Interrupted Serenade for sure, and it was, I showed you a little bit of Puck, it was true in that as well. Very often there's a sense of no connection whatsoever. We go from point A to point B without the line drawn in between, and I think Schumann did that.
Yeah, something like Fantasiestücke.
Fantasiestücke Kreisleriana is the one I think of above all.
Which has the literary connection.
It has the literary connection. But that's probably a minor influence. I know he did not like Beethoven, so it's somehow easier to talk about who he didn't like than who he did. I think he talked more about them himself. I think he liked Mozart. I think he liked Chopin. Chopin, of course, was an honorary French composer having lived in Paris. And we know also that he was very influenced by Stravinsky, whose ballets are being written at exactly the same time.
Well, he was older than Stravinsky. That's interesting. He was about 20 years older.
Yeah, but Petrushka, I think, was 1911, and the book two of the Preludes comes out in 1913. And there's a lot of the same kind of bitonal writing. Debussy, a lot of the Preludes take place with the right hand on the black keys, the left hand on the white keys. For instance, the first one of book two begins, I'm just leaping through it so that I could, I'm just trying to see if he says anything about that. He doesn't, but it's called Mist, and it sounds like this. And the left hand is playing all white keys, like that, just parallel triads, and the right hand starts on all black keys. So it creates, obviously, a dissonance, and a kind of bitonality. And later on in that same piece, you hear this, which is C major, F sharp major, C major. And that's precisely the two keys that Stravinsky juxtaposes on top of each other in Petrushka. So we have to believe, I mean, I don't think you could have been a musician in Paris at that time and not been aware of what Stravinsky was doing. I do think it's interesting, though, how differently Debussy does it, because it's the same kind of destruction of tonality that everybody is into at that time. Stravinsky and even more radically Schoenberg in Vienna and Ives in this country. But of all of them, Debussy does it the most unnoticeably in a way. It's so gentle that it doesn't, you know, people are so offended by dissonance often, and to this day people hate to listen to Schoenberg and even some Stravinsky, but nobody is offended by that, because it just sort of drifts by you. It has a kind of aura that we find, I think, so much just dreamy rather than sort of in our face.
Dreamy does seem to be the adjective that comes to mind. Also eclectic, because in what you've been playing so far, we'll hear snatches of everything, whether it's national anthems or little imitations of different things. You mentioned ragtime as one of the influences, too, in Debussy.
Yeah.
Which would be very unusual for that time, to take something from the African-American tradition, from Scott Joplin, and put it into a concert piece.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting thing. Apparently, I was just talking to Gunther Schuller about this, who's in residence here this semester, and what he pointed out, which in retrospect is sort of obvious, is that while in the United States, ragtime was so identified with African Americans that the elite legitimate composers didn't want to go near it because of the racism that just ran so deep in the country, in Europe, that wasn't the case. And so all these composers in Europe were perfectly happy, in fact, quite delighted to make use of ragtime, because the sorts of syncopations that it provided were exactly what they were interested in doing rhythmically. So I was thinking about it today, actually, as I was reading about all the riots in France, in Paris now, especially, and I think their own racism is sort of coming home to haunt them now. But at that point, they weren't thinking in racial terms, and they were perfectly happy to make use of this. And so there are a couple of the preludes that do. One of them is Minstrels, which is the last one of book one. And the minstrel shows in Paris at this time were put on by whites in blackface. So there's so many layers here of interesting social commentary, of course. But it starts like this. Obviously, it's very lighthearted and sort of tongue-in-cheek, and it has this same kind of cakewalk rhythm that he uses. Of course, he uses it in Golliwog's Cakewalk most famously, but also in General Levine Eccentric, which was the one I had played a little bit ago. And he says there, this is done in the style of a cakewalk. The ragtime as a kind of humor, and also as a way, I think, to use new kinds of rhythms. Yeah.
How does satie figure into the development of Debussy, or did they develop each other?
Well, I don't know. They were actually for quite a while good friends, and then they had a break and didn't speak to each other for a long time. I think they were both really difficult people, so it's probably remarkable is that they ever spoke to each other rather than that they stopped. Satie was a complete loner, always lived by himself, and there are all these stories about how he would walk miles to work because he didn't want to take any public transportation. When he died, they found 8 identical brown velour suits in his closet. I mean, he was really an odd man. Okay, but that doesn't necessarily mean he wasn't an influence on Debussy. He probably was. His music, I think, is clearly not as great as Debussy's, but it shares a little of the same mindset, partly in terms of its willingness to be funny, and partly in its interest in words.
The titles, for example.
Titles, and
really
not,
wacky titles.
Yeah, wacky. And not just the titles, but Satie writes texts often in the music. And in fact, I made a recording of Satie's Spoil Divertissement, which has texts all the way through it. And he's written somewhere that, you know, that he will essentially assassinate anybody who actually reads the text. They're meant, but I'm still here. Anyway, the texts are just meant to be private. They're just between him and the person playing it.
Including the titles.
Well, the titles, I suppose, would be...
There are some that seem to, and I don't want to get too much into Satie, but the fact that they both, bless them, have these wonderful titles,
yes.
Whereas classical music, for the most part, is so bland in its titling.
Don't you think that's also probably something of a rebellion against Germanic, sort of absolute Germanic music? All these symphonies, right? Beethoven and Brahms,
number one, number
and
two,
Mahler
number 10,
and Bruckner,
right?
And,
yes,
right. And so let's have something a little descriptive and a little bit light. I think that that's sort of what they have in common, and I think both of them are very engaged with words. Both in terms of their own writing and in terms of evoking.
You don't exactly listen to Satie and sometimes even Debussy. It's more like you uncork them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Satie, poor man, was the first person who thought of Muzak. He said that it would be so wonderful if you could have music in the background all the time. Lord knows what he would have thought.
Writing
if he'd seen where this has gotten us.
That's right. The elevator music and
exactly,
the dentist
exactly.
waiting room
and
music.
And I don't think that Debussy would have felt that. But Debussy was very taken with the idea of outdoor music and with music sort of blending with nature so that you really couldn't tell them apart anymore. And that's, of course, like the Peter Pan, too, right? Where you can't tell if the bird has actually laid an egg or if it's just Peter Pan playing the bird on his pipe. So that idea of music not being in sort of up on a stage, I think, would have appealed to both of them.
I've often seen Debussy compared to the Impressionist painters, and we're going to talk about the link between Debussy and art when we continue in a moment on University of the Year.
Learn something new every day. You tune in each weekday to participate in constructive dialogue that matters to you and to educate yourself about the local community, the nation, and the world. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Join me weekdays between 9 and 11 to engage the best thinkers of our time on the issues of the day.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is Catherine Kautsky at the piano and demonstrating the preludes of Claude Debussy. So often, apparently against his will, Debussy was linked to the term Impressionism. Does that make sense, do you think, that he would be considered an Impressionist?
You know, I think it's a complicated story. We do know that he didn't like the term. And there's been a lot made recently of the fact that he really seems more similar to the symbolist painters, and in that case, poets, than he does to the Impressionists. But I don't think it's quite that simple. There are certain things that it's hard to ignore. When you think about what a Monet painting, what characterizes things like some of the Monet paintings, the series paintings, for instance, where he paints the cathedral at Rouen in different lights. That sort of obsession with light and color is so much, I think, what Debussy is interested in also, and the kind of transparency of the writing in Debussy, what I was calling earlier maybe the gentleness of it, the fact that air sort of comes through the sound. I know that when fiddle players play the Debussy sonata, they always take care not to play near the bridge. You know, it's a fast bow far from the bridge so that there's air in the sound. And I think it's sort of like the light, you know, coming through the Monet paintings. Also the sort of palette, the use of lots of pastels, and then the haziness and blurring of lines. If you look at a Monet painting, you don't find right angles and clear delineation. And it's the same thing in Debussy. I mean, the use of pedal, I think we often over-pedal, but nevertheless, just to go back to that same example, because it's the prelude that's called Fog or Mist, I think it's hard not to feel that some of those characteristics are shared by the Impressionist painters.
It really does seem to go together, that misty feeling.
Yes.
And also the way, if you look at a Monet haystack, it's just a small object.
Yes.
And you're talking about Debussy taking something kind of understated, something quiet, something
right.
small, but so much happens.
I think the point that people are trying to make in pointing out the link with the symbolists is that, first of all, Debussy's friends were the symbolist poets. And so there we know there's an actual link. And secondly, the symbolist painters in France at this time, people like Redon and Moreau, were painting dream images. Whereas Monet is actually going out and studying a cathedral and trying to paint what he sees, the symbolists are much more trying to paint what's in their imagination or what's in their unconscious. And I think it's that sense of the unconscious, of the dream, of the fantasy and imagination that people are saying is so powerful in Debussy, and that if you only think about the sort of the use of color, the blurring of lines, you're missing a kind of inner content in the music. So there's no reason one has to choose. This is a man who obviously absorbed every influence around him. So why should we say that he absorbed one and not the other? They were both there, you know? And it's not only those. When you said that the idea of taking a small object, Japanese prints had just arrived in Paris at this time. There was, at the 1889 World Exposition, apparently lots of objects arrived wrapped in Japanese prints, sort of like newspaper that you're supposed to pitch. But people realized their value and were enormously taken with them for a lot of reasons, partly the miniaturism, but also this sort of sense of implication that isn't completely spelled out for you. And so there's a wonderful sense there of possibility. And very often the action goes off of the page. That is, you don't see a complete picture. You know that something is continuing that you can't see. So this sort of sense of things that are implicit but not absolute. Again, like Peter Pan's flute, right? So that was clearly an influence on him. We know that. He wrote a set of piano pieces called Estampe, which means prints, and it refers to Japanese prints. The first piece in it evokes the bells of the gamelan and the scale of the gamelan, which came also not from Japan, but at the same World Exposition when things were suddenly arriving from the East. So lots of different art influences, also the influence of Art Nouveau, which was very important in Paris at this time. If you go to Paris and you see some of the metro stops still exist that are Art Nouveau, this very sort of curvaceous, wonderful wrought iron. And there are these incredible pictures of women with long, long sort of curvy hair. And to me, that's what Maiden with the Flaxen Hair is all about. I mean, it starts with this arabesque. Right, that sort of turns on itself very much the way you see these long, long tresses in the Art Nouveau paintings of the time.
And then you get those lush chords settling in right
That's
after that.
That's true, too. I'm not sure how that correlates with art, but it doesn't all happen, right?
You know? It sounds great, whatever the correlation, if any.
Yeah. So anyway, I think the Impressionists, the Symbolists, the Japanese prints Art Nouveau, and then we've already talked about children's book illustrations, too, these fantastic, what are called fairy paintings by Arthur Rackham.
And you mentioned that he's always attracted to this sort of world in between, which would take us to something like a mermaid or a you know, some sort of a mythical creature that's half divine, half human.
Yeah, he loves fairies. He loves things that fly and that somehow allow him to break all the rules.
But he's great with water, too.
Oh, he's great with water, too. And so the one that obviously comes to mind here is Ondine, who's this water mermaid. And the prelude begins like this. So you already hear, right in the first eight bars, that this girl, or mermaid, whatever she is completely capricious, right? I mean, she can't make up her mind which musical figure to stay with. So, you know, she begins with something ever so slightly predictable. But then it vanishes, sort of like in a spray of water or something. And later on, we get all this very obvious water music, so that the pictures that Arthur Rackham has painted of her as this very lovely mermaid, you know, with the top portion of her body that of a girl and the bottom portion that of a tail, so that she looks like a fish, you know, the bottom portion is a fish. So we can really imagine her in this music sort of gliding through the water. At the very end of the piece, you have this passage. You know, I think Debussy was very attracted, not just to fairies and mermaids, but to water, as you said, mm-hmm. because it offered this kind of mystery. That you look in it and you see a reflection, but the reflection is somehow distorted, right? It's not quite real, and you can never see to the bottom of it, and light is reflected in it always in very different ways. So this idea of combining a girl, a mermaid, and the water in one prelude must have been wonderful for him, and it's one of the great ones of the preludes.
I would think the idea of depicting a sunken cathedral would be another one that would come to mind.
Funny you should think of that.
Is that really an aquatic piece, do you think?
Sunken
do we
cathedral?
Really get water in that, or is it kind of more of the
effect of the sunken cathedral
city?
Is such an aquatic piece, actually. That's a good way to put it. I think that sunken cathedral is too massive to be really about water, because water is always in motion. And this is more about really a large edifice. This story for the sunken cathedral goes back to an old legend from Brittany, apparently. It's about an isle called Iss, I-S. I don't, or sometimes it's spelled Y-S. In any case, the story was that somehow the inhabitants misbehaved. In the version I read, it was the daughter of the king who misbehaved, and she gave the keys to the dike to her very undesirable boyfriend, who proceeded to open it, and the water overflowed, and the entire city was drowned. But the cathedral would emerge every once in a while with its bells tolling to remind the world of what becomes of inhabitants who sin. So that was the story behind this cathedral. And this piece is, of course, one of the most famous of the preludes, is probably the most programmatic of them. Most of them just have a sort of evocative title. You know, you read the title and you get a sort of nice mood. But this one actually tells the story. It starts out very softly, and I'll play you a little bit. Then it grows gradually, and it says, little by little, emerging from the fog, and then eventually you have the cathedral right there in front of you. So it starts out with these open intervals that are very much like church organum. And eventually you hear this, and it's interesting because it forms an arch form. You can hear it going up and coming down, just as a church arch might. And that grows and grows until you get this. I there's just a single note left. So this is, it's obviously a very sort of visual evocation of this old legend.
It's orchestral. You can see why
yes.
Stokowski could not resist putting real bells in where
yes.
it sounded as Debussy had
yeah.
them.
Debussy loved bells. I mean, this is probably the one that's most obvious, but there are bells all over the place. And it's not just Debussy, it's Ravel, too.
Yes.
I mean, Ravel actually wrote a piano piece called Les Cloches. But I think they found that bells had this kind of resonance for them of childhood, of important events in life, right? It's for birth and marriage and death that the bells toll, right? And there's also something about the sound of a bell. It has so many overtones that the vibrations continue. It doesn't end at a particular moment. There's not a cutoff. So it must have been both what the bell stood for in life and also the actual sound of it.
And that wonderful just blurriness that Debussy liked
yes.
so much.
Yes,
such
exactly.
an amazing range that he has in the preludes. Is there a sort of a theme running through all of them besides this faraway place, the variety, the color, the play?
You know, I think it is the farawayness of it, but it comes in so many different guises. I mean, one we haven't talked about, but it's important, too, is location. I mean, there's one near the end called Canope. It starts like this. And that Canope was a city in Egypt, and Debussy apparently owned a couple of funereal urns that were they were named after this
canopic
city.
Jars.
Exactly, there you are. Yes, and so you have this, here you have Egypt all of a sudden. In the beginning you have the dancers of Delphi. Sounds like this. That was apparently taken from a sculpture that he saw in the Louvre. And then you have another one that evokes Spain, Puerto del Vino, with this habanera rhythm, which actually goes back to ragtime that we were talking about before. Very Spanish. So there's, you know, he chooses places that I think are, for him, a bit exotic. So even though Spain, of course, borders on France, for the French, Spain, I think, was this place of sort of hot climes and sensuality and sort of forbidden pleasures. So there it is, you know, it's far away. And then you have Delphi and you have Egypt. How much farther away can you get in terms of sort of chronological distance. So for me, I think that's what the theme is. The very last prelude, of course, takes place right in France, and that can't be a coincidence. It's called Fireworks. It begins like this, and it ends like this, which is a quote from Amarcyse, and that's how the cycle comes to an end. So in the end, he does come home, but listen to how far away it is. Right? And the prelude's actually been quite loud and fast. But at the end, La Marseillaise is somehow put at a distance. So nothing is ever quite right in front of you.
Catherine Kowski, thank you for being right in front of us and guiding us through the preludes of Claude Debussy and a wonderful, rich world it is, too.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, I think, for how much it tells us both about music and about life in Paris at that time.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.